Have you noticed hair collecting at the bottom of the tub or shower stall? Do you worry about a receding hairline or hair loss? This is the People's Pharmacy with Terry and Joe Graydon.
Hair loss can be caused by many things. Changes in hormones are often accompanied by hair thinning. Immune system disorders like rheumatoid arthritis can impact hair growth. What about the drugs you need to take for this condition? Are there medications for hypertension that may be linked to excessive hair loss?
What about the drugs that people use to combat hair loss? How well do they work? Are there medicines that are helpful for women as well as men?
Coming up on the People's Pharmacy, find out how you can keep your hair healthy. In the People's Pharmacy Health Headlines, the FDA has alerted health professionals and consumers that some batches of the popular heartburn medicine ranitidine, also sold under the brand name Zantac, could contain a probable carcinogen. The nitrosamine, NDMA, has been found in both prescription and over-the-counter forms of this drug. NDMA is the same compound that was discovered in Chinese-made valsartan blood pressure pills. Valisure, the pharmacy that discovered the NDMA in ranitidine, has petitioned the FDA to recall this H2 antagonist. The Food and Drug Administration is evaluating whether NDMA poses a risk to patients. The FDA is not calling for individuals to stop taking Zantac or its generic equivalent. The agency notes, however, that there are a number of other pharmaceutical options for treating symptoms of heartburn.
Fluoroquinolone antibiotics like Cipro or Levaquin have been prescribed for sinus, lung, and urinary tract infections. For decades, such drugs were perceived as safe and effective treatment options. Gradually, the FDA recognized that there were some serious adverse reactions, including tendinitis, tendon rupture, nerve damage, hallucinations, psychosis, irregular heart rhythms, and aortic aneurysms, to name just a few. A new study published in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology reports that people taking fluoroquinolone antibiotics are almost 2.5 times more likely to have leaky heart valves while they're on this medicine compared to people taking amoxicillin. The FDA advises health professionals to reserve fluoroquinolones for situations when no alternative treatment options exist.
Public health authorities are encouraging people to get their annual flu vaccine now. Every year, people suffering influenza and similar viral illness miss a lot of work and school. In addition, the flu can lead to serious complications that require hospitalization. Pregnant women, older people, very young children, and those with chronic diseases affecting the lungs or the heart are more vulnerable to such problems or even death. No one knows how severe the coming influenza season will be or whether this year's vaccine will be effective. We can look to Australia, however, where flu season is just wrapping up. The Southern Hemisphere is always 6 months ahead. It wasn't particularly severe, and it lasted not quite as long as usual. Their 2019 flu outbreak had a preponderance of influenza A, H3N2. The vaccine didn't match as well as authorities had hoped. We won't know how well American flu shots will match circulating viruses until we're well into the season. Last year, the vaccine was not very effective against H3N2.
Tick-borne diseases have doubled in recent years and are spreading across the country. Climate change is one likely contributor to this epidemic. Lyme disease is not the only problem. A new study examined ticks on Long Island and found that they can carry multiple disease-causing pathogens. A single tick can transmit more than one disease. More than half of the deer ticks examined carried the bacteria that causes Lyme disease. Many also were infected with other species of Borrelia as well as Anaplasma and Powassan. People bitten by a Lone Star tick may also develop southern tick-associated rash illness, known as Starry. The meat allergy syndrome alpha-gal can also be triggered by the bite of Amblyomma americanum. Dog ticks carry rickettsia that can cause Rocky Mountain spotted fever. When people are infected by more than one pathogen, it may be more difficult to diagnose and treat the resulting diseases.
Do you take your blood pressure at home? This practice can be helpful for anyone, but the Dallas Heart Study found it's especially useful for African American adults. Blood pressure readings obtained by research associates out of the office were better for predicting a serious complication than those done in the clinic. The authors conclude that blood pressure measurement and management outside the medical office is crucial to preventing hypertensive heart disease. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.
Welcome to the People's Pharmacy. I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. Have you ever had a bad hair day? I've certainly had my share. Almost everyone has. A lot of people aren't happy with their hair even on a good hair day. Do you worry that your hair is thinning? Is there anything you can do about it?
To help us learn more about keeping hair healthy and what can be done about hair loss, we turn to Dr. Chris Adigan. She's a board-certified dermatologist who practices at the Dermatology and Laser Center of Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Welcome back to the People's Pharmacy, Dr. Chris Adigan.
Thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Adigan, your hair is so important to your sense of well-being. We often hear, oh, I'm having a bad hair day. Ooh, look in the mirror, gross. Let's just start at the very beginning. What is hair?
So hair is a protein, essentially a complex of proteins known as keratins. And so it is produced by our skin. So it's one of our appendages. So if you think about what comprises skin, it actually is a skin and its appendages, so including nails as well as hair. And it is produced by our skin in the hair follicle. What also feeds in that follicle is the oil gland, and this opens up onto our skin in a pore. So out comes the hair as well as any oil that will nourish the skin.
One of the things that seems very strange about humans is no matter what we were born with, no matter what our hair looks like, we wish it were different. So if we have...
Here, I thought you were going to say humans, they only have hair on their heads and a few other places, and animals have fur all over them.
And some people have fur all over them, too.
But I was thinking, you know, if you have curly hair, you want straight hair. If you have straight hair, you want curly hair. If you have blonde hair, you want darker hair. If you have dark hair, you want blonde hair. If it's too straight, it's too thick, it's too thin...
Why can't we just love our hair?
That is a very good question. And, you know, that's why we have all these great cosmetic services available to us to change the color or to change the texture. I think the biggest trauma people have with hair is when they start to lose it.
Yeah, right.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And why? Let's just hop right on that. Why? Why is it that some people in their 80s or 90s can have a full head of hair and other people in their 20s or 30s, I'm thinking mostly of men, can have what we call male pattern baldness? And you say, what? But how can that be?
But even women can have hair loss in their 20s or 30s, and it's very distressing.
It is very distressing. In fact, in studies, they show that hair loss, especially in the younger ages or the younger age groups, 20s to 30s or 30s to 40s, is more traumatic for women than it is for men. And so it's, I'm happy that you brought that up, because it's easy to kind of concentrate on men and their hair loss when really it's happening to women at the same time during the same time period.
Why?
So that is a very good question, because there's so many answers, right? There's so many factors that can lead to hair loss or worsen hair loss. So someone that has the right genetics to lose their hair or the wrong genetics to lose their hair from an earlier age. And then there's all these compounding variables, right? Stress, overall health, other diseases, medications, different types of supplements that they may think that are going to help them that could actually hurt their hair. So there's all these factors that can worsen hair loss. But genetics play a big factor in that early onset hair loss more than Like, that's the first thing that I'm going to dive into when a young person comes to me with a pattern type hair loss or diffuse hair loss. But then there's also types of hair losses that can happen in early childhood. Those are almost uniformly of an autoimmune type of hair loss.
You're talking alopecia areata.
That's exactly what I'm talking about.
And what exactly is that?
Alopecia areata is a type of autoimmune hair loss where immune cells will actually target a certain part of the hair follicle and cause that hair follicle to fall out, or cause the hair to fall out.
And then the hair follicle may or may not regenerate itself?
Well, the follicle actually remains right there in the dermis, but there's no hair growing because it's surrounded by these immune cells. So it's a reversible type of hair loss, not a scarring hair loss. So alopecia areata actually can be treated.
How? I mean, because for a child, let's say age 8 or 9, to all of a sudden lose all the hair on his or her body, I mean, that can be really traumatic.
Or it could be just a large patch, right?
Yes, it can. Either one of those scenarios can happen. I will say that the more extensive the hair loss, the more difficult it is to treat. The patchy type hair loss is easier to treat and more likely to resolve in time. The more extensive hair loss, alopecia universalis, when it involves all of the hair on the entire body, maybe also including the eyebrows, maybe even the eyelashes as well, is more difficult to treat. But the patchy is far more common, and that's what we'll see in day-to-day practice of dermatology. And we can either treat that with injectable anti-inflammatory agents, such as a steroid, or topical steroid agents, usually super potent type steroids, because they need to absorb through the epidermis, all the way in the dermis, get all the way down to the hair follicle. So you need something that's effective. When those aren't working, or they're not working well for the family, because, of course, the parents have to be well involved in this treatment when it's a child, we sometimes use topical agents that are called sensitizers. So agents that will basically give the skin a rash, but it distracts from those immune cells down around the hair follicle. They come up to the surface of the skin, and then the hair will grow. So that's another option. And then there are new agents.
Well, we've heard rumors that there's a category of diabetes medication. What are they? JAK inhibitors, Terry? Mm-hmm.
JAK2.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, JAK. I don't remember what that stands for, but give us the inside scoop on this category and how they're working.
So those are the JAK kinase type medications, and they do actually have their place in the rheumatologic literature as well. So they do work well with these autoimmune type conditions. And so alopecia areata is an autoimmune condition where your immune system, of course, is targeting part of itself, similar to the rheumatologic disorders where those immune complexes are targeting themselves. And there is new literature showing that some of these agents have their place for alopecia areata, and it's very exciting, especially for some of those more extensive cases that you can't just maybe inject that one little patch on the head or put cream on one place.
Let's go back to the more typical male pattern baldness, whether it's a man or a woman, and talk about the genetics, because this seems to be pretty complicated. There are situations where, for example, the father has pretty significant baldness and the daughter does just fine, but the son seems to be more vulnerable to the baldness on the mother's side. I mean, so do we know anything about how this genetic relationship works?
You just described that so well, because so often people will come in and they will have a family tree written for me, and they have like a case like, well, but my mother has a full head of hair and my paternal grandmother has a full head of hair. But then why don't I have hair? You know, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm, right.
Really, I think the best way to think about it is that pattern hair loss is familial, which means that we know that it runs in families. We know there's a genetic component, but we don't have it well defined. And a lot of times people will kind of want to think about that maternal grandfather. And honestly, I don't really know where that came from. Nowhere in all of my dermatology training did we just focus on the maternal grandfather.
So this is more of an urban legend.
I don't like to say that because I don't really know where it originated. But I will say that I'm going to do a very thorough family history. And because everyone in that family history plays a role, whether it's your mother and father are number one. So mother with with pattern hair loss, we see that being a little bit of a stronger component to hair loss in either a son or a daughter. But of course, the father's hair loss plays a role. Then I'll kind of dive back into the grandparents. And all along the way, I don't want to miss anything, such as thyroid disease or other confounding variables. So it's also my responsibility to make sure that I'm not missing any other components that could be contributing to that hair loss. But I always have the conversation and explain that hair loss is almost always multifactorial, and we want to do everything we can to optimize the chances of regrowing that hair.
What are some of the other factors? You mentioned the thyroid gland.
Yeah, so both thyroid overactivity or thyroid underactivity can contribute to hair loss. And we know that that can also pose a threat to their overall health, cardiovascular health, and even neurological health. And so as a dermatologist, if they're presenting with hair loss and it's their first presenting sign of their thyroid disease, it's my job to catch it and help them get to the right kind of doctor to have that treated.
And if you're successful and they do go to the endocrinologist and they get their thyroid back in order, does the hair come back?
Oftentimes when they're younger, it can recover. It may not recover completely, and I do try to manage those expectations from the very beginning, but a lot of times it can actually recover.
We understand there's one distinctive pattern of hair loss that really can signal hypothyroidism, and that is when the outer third of the eyebrows just disappears. Your thoughts?
Yes, that's called madarosis, and that is well established to be a presenting sign or a longstanding sign of hypothyroidism, so low thyroid hormone. I do see it also in alopecia areata and another type of hair loss known as frontal fibrosing alopecia. But the first thing I will do is check their thyroid hormone level.
You're listening to Dr. Chris Adigan. She's a board-certified dermatologist who practices at the Dermatology and Laser Center of Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
You know, Terry, as a pharmacologist, I find these Janus kinase inhibitors, JAK, J-A-K, fascinating, because they were developed originally for rheumatoid arthritis.
Right, but they are used for some other autoimmune diseases like psoriasis or ulcerative colitis.
And they seem to work surprisingly well against alopecia areata. The problem is that when you stop using them, the hair falls out again.
It might recur,
yeah.
Right. I think it's tofacitinib, Xeljanz, that has been tested for alopecia areata.
Yeah, just really interesting. We need to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to learn more about cyclical hair loss with thyroid hormone changes.
Can hair really turn white overnight if someone's had a huge shock? You do hear that sometimes.
We do. I think it may be an urban legend. There are a few drugs that are prescribed to stimulate hair regrowth. How well do they work?
Some of these drugs are not appropriate during pregnancy. What other side effects might they have?
And what should you know about using minoxidil, also known as Rogaine?
You're listening to The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon. Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Terry Graydon.
And I'm Joe Graydon.
The People's Pharmacy is brought to you in part by Verizama, an analytical laboratory providing home health tests for hormones, gut health, and the microbiome, online at Verizana, Verisana.com.
And by Cocavia, the maker of high-potency cocoa flavanol supplements that support cognitive and cardiovascular health. More information at cocavia.com. That's C-O-C-O-A-V-I-A.com.
Today, we're exploring the problem of hair loss. What are the causes? How can we address it?
Our guest is Dr. Chris Adigun. That's A-D-I-G-U-N. She's a board-certified dermatologist who practices at the Dermatology and Laser Center of Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Dr. Adigun, I myself have a hypothyroid condition. I've had it for many decades. And my hair cutter and I have noticed that there is a pattern to my hair loss. So in the late summer and early fall, my hair starts to fall out. And by the spring, it's starting to grow back again. Now, I actually find that I need a little more thyroid hormone during the winter in order to feel good. And I have always attributed the fact that I'm getting that little more thyroid hormone and feeling better to the, I think that's the reason why the hair starts to grow back. But I could be wrong. Is this something you've ever seen before?
So we call that cycling, right? So in kind of the dermatology speak, when we see someone's hair fall out and then regrow or recover, sometimes we use that term, we call that hair cycling. And it appears that you have all your hairs tend to cycle around the same time. And that is how you're able to observe it, which is actually pretty fantastic. We don't always get to see that. And we can't totally explain it. It may or may not have anything to do with your thyroid hormone levels. I do think that we see it more often when people are on kind of exogenous type supplements to keep their thyroid hormone correct, right? But we only know that it's right by these blood tests. But your body will have different needs over the course of the year and over the course of, I guess, the seasons, and your thyroid needs will change, but your thyroid supplement will stay the same, or your thyroid medication, which is usually supplemental hormone. But that cycling, we can't totally explain, but we do see it and observe it and report it.
What else can cause hair thinning? You mentioned stress. You know, we blame a lot of things on stress. Can that really cause hair loss?
So, yes. When I say stress, that can either be a true physical stress on the body, such as like a febrile illness, or it can be extreme emotional stress, such as a bereavement. And that we see in those circumstances, we see elevated cortisol levels in the blood. We're able to measurably see elevated cortisol levels in the blood. And those elevated cortisol levels reach all areas of our body, whether it is our skin, our organs, as well as our hair follicles. And we know that increased cortisol stress, or stress hormone of cortisol, can lead to an increased percentage of your hair shifting to the resting phase, known as telogen phase. And when you have an increased percentage of your hair shift from the anagen, or the growing phase, to the telogen phase, then you will notice that you will have shedding, or an increased numbers of hairs lost per day for several months. We also see this in pregnancy. So during pregnancy, you actually have the opposite shift. You have a higher percentage of your hairs go into the anagen, or the growing phase, and a smaller percentage going into the telogen, or the resting phase. Then you have the baby, and several months later, that pendulum swings back, and all those telogen hairs start to fall out.
And so you have a fair amount of hair loss, and it can be quite alarming.
It can be very alarming. So you have a new baby.
And you say, stress.
That's right. You say, stress. I mean, a lot of times I'll see someone, that's especially a young person, a young woman, I will ask, you know, what happened 3 to 6 months ago in your life? And sometimes it is a new baby. And we can then have some education about that, and I can kind of support them through that regrowing period. Or it was a febrile illness or an extreme stressful event.
Well, speaking of extreme stressful events, we've heard what I suspect is an urban legend, that some people, after going through an unbelievable, scary situation, their hair turns white overnight. And I'm going, wait a minute.
We've never seen this happen.
And hair is dead. How could it turn white?
So That is a phenomenal urban legend, but I've actually heard that one in dermatology as well, similar to the other ones we talked about. We think of that as in the family, as alopecia areata, because alopecia areata autoimmune cells target the pigment in the hair follicle.
As well as targeting the hair follicle itself.
That's right. So the hair falls out, but then the new hair that grows in oftentimes is white or blonde.
Okay.
And so you can have the overnight gray when that new growth comes in and it doesn't have pigment.
What does cause gray hair and why do different people get gray at different times?
That's also familial. There are certain genetic conditions where we can actually name the genetic polymorphism that leads to either early graying. But most of the time, that is not the case, right? Because most humans will gray over the course of our lifetimes, and that's not due to some kind of genetic mutation.
Right.
And it's familial most of the time because we see that it tends to run in families, but we can't tell you exactly how.
Why haven't dermatologists come up with solutions? And when I say solutions, I mean better ways to deal with male pattern baldness. We've got what? Basically two kinds of treatments. We've got the topical minoxidil, which I think is sold under the brand name Rogaine.
That's right. Or you can buy the generic.
And there's now generic minoxidil. And this was originally a blood pressure medication, right?
But it works much better to grow hair, right?
That's right, with far fewer side effects.
Right. But how well does it work, really? So I want the inside scoop on these hair growth restores. And then we've got the, do they call them the 5-alpha reductase inhibitors?
That's
so
right.
We've got the Proscar, which is finasteride, which was originally to shrink the prostate. And then there's its kissing cousin, dutasteride, which is Avodart. So how well do these two different kinds of drugs actually work? And why don't we have something that's really great?
I think that's a really great question. But I will say that there's always an enormous amount of research in how to regrow hair, because as we talked about earlier, hair loss does cause an enormous amount of psychological distress, even though it is so common. So finasteride and dutasteride are the 5-alpha DHT receptor inhibitors. So that's one of the testosterone receptors that is most present on the hair follicle, also present on the prostate gland. And so we saw in these patients that were on the medication for their benign prosthetic hypertrophy that they were growing hair. And it was like, oh, look at this. But that's how a lot of medications are discovered.
So it was a side effect.
It was a welcome side effect,
there,
right?
You have it.
Similar to another medication that we use for lash growth, known as latanoprost. So
we're going to come back to that in a second, because that's a really interesting issue. People do care about their eyelashes.
They do.
But so how well do those DHT inhibitors, because they're lowering levels of dihydrotestosterone.
That is correct.
How well do they actually work compared to, for example, minoxidil?
So what they do is they block the receptor. So they don't actually lower the levels in your system, but they inhibit its ability to affect the hair follicle. And obviously, when it does affect the hair follicle, it makes that hair follicle fall out. And they work quite well. And what we have found is they work better when people start them younger. So when someone comes to me with very advanced hair loss in their 50s or 60s and they don't have any hair on their head, I do not tell them that we're going to start finasteride and they are going to grow hair on their head.
Because it's not likely that it will work very well.
That is correct. No. But before the follicles miniaturize, which is part of the pathophysiology of pattern hair loss, when it's very early in its phase, so whether that's in their 20s in extreme circumstances, 30s, which is actually most circumstances, or in their 40s, I will start it then in men. And they can have a really fantastic result. They will hold on to more hair over time, so that prevents loss, which is a lot easier than growing new hair, right? Holding on to the hair you have is easier to do. And then they can have some regrowth if they've had some early loss. It does work very well in women. So I prescribe both of these medications depending on the circumstance in women. And I will actually prescribe it even to women in their 50s that have had some hair loss, because it seems to be even marginally more effective in women for a longer period of time. And part of that may be due to kind of women presenting a little bit later with that hair loss. The key is starting early.
I think they're not supposed to get pregnant. So this would presumably have to be in a woman
postmenopausal, presumably.
Or, that is correct.
Or so, otherwise assuring that she will not get pregnant.
That's right. And I, you know, required several different methods to show that they are not able to get pregnant while on this medication.
In addition to the potential for problems with the fetus if a woman were to get pregnant, there are some other side effects to these medications. Mm-hmm. What do you warn people about?
The biggest side effect, and I think it's most well documented in men, are the what we call sexual side effects, which is kind of a bucket of side effects that includes erectile dysfunction, which is more or less a bucket, whether it's a difficulty to attain or sustain an erection or decreased desire. All of that goes into that same bucket of sexual side effects. That being said, the incidence is still very low, but we always have this conversation prior to starting it. It is not as pronounced or demonstrated as much in females.
I imagine a lot of men would go, wait a minute, I'm not sure I want to trade in my hair for less interest and ability to enjoy sex. But that's a conversation that you can have with each patient. What about minoxidil? Because initially it made headlines. Everybody was so excited. You put the stuff on your head. And it was supposed to grow a lot of hair, and it doesn't seem to have been a home run.
Well, it kind of depends. I'm still very excited about minoxidil.
Okay.
I think minoxidil works fantastically well. It also has an excellent safety profile.
Mm-hmm.
And it is what's called an anagen promoter. So what its goal is to shift more of those hairs into the growing phase and out of that resting phase. And so it actually works for many different types of hair loss, whether they just were diagnosed with thyroid disease and they need to recover from their massive telogen effluvium, or they had a massive telogen effluvium after delivery of a baby. And these are all certain circumstances where telogen effluvium is kind of hanging around longer than we want, and it can work fantastically well in those circumstances. It also, again, has that excellent safety profile, which I review with patients because they always ask me, well, how long do I need to use the minoxidil? And because it's going to stop working when I stop it, I say, absolutely. That's part of the reason why it's safe. It works while you're on it, and you will lose the hair that you gained from it when you decide to stop it. But similar to lots of medications that we take for different types of chronic conditions, such as high blood pressure, high cholesterol, they work when you're on them.
And as a topical medicine, I assume, although obviously some of it is going to be absorbed into the systemic circulation, it presumably has fewer side effects than a pill that you might take.
Yes, it does. It has an enormously lower risk profile than any kind of systemic agent.
You mentioned that you do sometimes prescribe the dutasteride or finasteride for women. Minoxidil has been used for women for a long time, even though it was originally developed for men.
That is correct. As many medications across all of our medical literature, across all specialties, the study subjects almost always are men to begin with.
What about developments on the horizon? I'm sure that there are a lot of drug companies and dermatologists and men and women, for that matter, who would like to see the home run, the really full head of hair restored to original color. How do we get those hair follicles to wake up and go back to their, you know, wonderful early phase of making hair the way it was originally created?
That's a very difficult question to answer because there are just so many different factors. But one of the kind of new avenues in development are how do we optimize the environment for the hair follicle, making sure the hair follicle has all of the building blocks that it needs to grow a new hair, making sure the environment around the hair follicle is has as low inflammation as possible. So fewer inflammatory cells kind of in the area around the hair follicle to promote its growth. So we have these medications that stop the hormonal hair loss or slow it, such as the finasteride and dutasteride. We have the topical medication, minoxidil, that tells the hair, move into anagen phase. So we've had these products. However, they don't optimize the environment for the hair follicle. So many of the newer agents, whether they are other orals, such as different types of supplements, or their actual injectable agents injecting your own growth factors from your own protein-rich plasma that is drawn when you have your blood drawn, Or there's even new different types of lights that come in the forms of caps that you put on your head that try to improve the environment around the hair follicle. All of whether they're device-based or in procedural, such as injections, or oral, they're all trying to achieve the same thing.
We promised we'd talk a little bit about eyelashes. You mentioned a drug. I believe it was originally developed for, was it glaucoma?
That's right, for glaucoma.
What's the story?
So may I use brand names?
Sure.
So, Latisse is the product that is most widely known and well-studied and has a great safety profile for growing lashes. And we see that it works well in patients that have lost their lashes due to stressful type hair losses or even due to autoimmune type hair loss. It tends to work in those patients as well. It will make longer, fuller lashes. Sometimes we see new lash growth, but most of the time it actually improves the overall quality of the lashes that are already there. So when I'm using Latisse, a lot of times patients will also want to put it on their eyebrows. I don't find that it works very well for growing new eyebrow hairs. It will make the existing eyebrow hairs sometimes longer, which is not always a wanted outcome.
Not necessarily the desired effect.
That's right.
So it can, however, make eyelashes grow longer and thicker?
And thicker, mm-hmm, and more prominent and have a very nice result. And it's applied directly to the lash line once a day.
So you put it on as though it were mascara or something like that?
You put it on as though it were like a liquid eyeliner.
Oh, okay.
And it really works.
And it really works.
You're listening to Dr. Chris Adigan. She's a board-certified dermatologist who practices at the Dermatology and Laser Center of Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Terry, you know, the development of Latisse is really kind of, again, a fascinating story in pharmacology because the drug was originally known generically as latanoprost. Well, it still is for that matter. The brand name was Xalatan, spelled X-A-L-A-T-A-N. I always love these names, you know, the planet Xalatan. but it works. It was a revolutionary treatment for glaucoma.
For glaucoma, exactly. And so Xalatan is applied to the eye as an eye drop. And they found that it had this interesting side effect.
Well, not only did it apparently grow lashes, but it can also change eye color, mostly from blue to brown.
Brown, or from hazel to darker brown.
Right. Now, that's because you're putting the drops in the eye. It's apparently far less common if you just put it along the lash line. And
as long as your aim is good.
As long as your aim is good. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll talk about medications that could cause hair loss.
Are there alternate medicines that are less likely to trigger this problem?
We'll also find out if you can reduce your risk of hair loss due to cancer chemotherapy.
Does rheumatoid arthritis make your hair fall out? What about the drugs you need to take for this condition?
And you'll find out what to do to keep your hair healthy.
You're listening to The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon.
Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. The People's Pharmacy is brought to you in part by CocoVia, offering plant-based nutrients in the form of cocoa flavanols for brain and heart health. Online at CocoVia.com.
And by Kaya Biotics. Probiotic products made in Germany from certified organic ingredients. K-A-Y-A Biotics.com.
Our topic today is hair loss. Are there medications and clinical conditions that contribute to hair loss? Is there anything that can be done to mitigate hair loss caused by chemotherapy?
Our guest is Dr. Chris Adigan, a board-certified dermatologist who practices at the Dermatology and Laser Center of Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Dr. Adigan, we sometimes hear from people who say, is it possible that the medication I'm taking could be causing my hair loss?
It's our job to discover whether or not that is the case.
So, do medicines frequently cause hair loss?
I don't think I would go so far as to say they frequently cause hair loss, but I will say that we have to do our due diligence in working up a patient with hair loss to make sure not one of their medications is not contributing to it.
We've heard beta blockers, for example, but I'm guessing what you said earlier about the process of hair loss, you don't just start taking a medication and like Thursday and then Monday your hair falls out. It's a very long, gradual process. So this requires some detective work.
It does. I mean, that's part of what's fun about our job, right? And so I think one big distinction to make here is a lot of times people think of, oh, my medication's causing my hair loss. They think of kind of chemotherapeutic agents. That's a sudden type of hair loss because it's a different type of hair loss. But the lion's share of hair loss that's in, kind of worsened by medications is a telogen effluvium type hair loss. Which
remind us what that means.
Sure. So that's called the resting phase of the follicle. So at any given time, you should have about 90% of your hair in the anagen phase or the growing phase and 10% in the resting phase, which will ultimately fall out 3 months from the time it shifts to telogen.
So if somebody says, well, my doctor just put me on propranolol for my high blood pressure about 4 months ago, and boy, my hair just seems to be coming out. I see it in the drain of the shower. Could that be responsible? That would raise a red flag for you.
Absolutely. That's the perfect timeline.
And of course, no one should ever stop taking a beta blocker or any medication suddenly, but there are sometimes alternatives that might not have that side effect.
That's right. And that's when I get on the phone to their primary care doctor and we kind of start working things out after I've already ruled out other potential causes of the hair loss.
So what alternative treatment could they use for their blood pressure or whatever problem they're being treated
for? Right. And then the next step with the patient is having to explain to them that they're probably going to continue shedding for another couple of months, even if they're off the inciting agent and on a newer agent that won't cause that side effect. We're in it for the long haul. It's going to take at least 6 months or so.
Now, you mentioned chemotherapy, and obviously, you probably can't find an alternative treatment if the patient is on chemotherapy. The oncologist has selected this particular drug because it's the one that will hopefully get their cancer under control. We don't want to mess with that. Are there any things that can be done to reduce the likelihood or the extent of hair loss during chemotherapy?
There actually is, and this is now kind of in common use with chemotherapy administration, and it's called hypothermia, like a hypothermia treatment to the scalp. Like an ice cap, exactly. I think they call it a hypothermic cap. So what they're doing is they put the cap on about 30 minutes prior to administration of the chemotherapy. And what that does is causes all of the vessels around the hair follicles to constrict. So there's a smaller amount of blood flow to those individual follicles. Then they administer the chemotherapy, and depending on the agent, it takes a set amount of time. They stop the chemotherapy administration, and then they leave the cap on for another hour, sometimes longer, sometimes a little bit shorter, but an hour is about the average, to, again, keep those vessels around the hair follicles constricted. And what that does is decreases the chemotherapy exposure to those vulnerable hair follicle cells.
But I suspect a lot of people, after undergoing chemotherapy, after their hair falls out, it does come back.
It does. That is the usual narrative, is that the hair will come back. It may be a strange color. It may be a strange texture, but their hair tends to grow back. It's unusual for it not to, and we are able to manage those circumstances usually.
Now when you say strange, you mean not what it was before.
That's right.
It's not going to be purple.
That's right. Not the color they would expect it to be. It may be a little bit lighter.
Now, speaking of different texture and different color, we have heard, and I suspect this is rare, but from people taking statins to control their cholesterol, some people say, well, you know, I kind of got used to my white hair. I mean, it literally turned white. I'm 74. And then I started taking rosuvastatin or atorvastatin, and now it's kind of coming back different. Can the statin actually affect hair?
There have been rare reports of this. Yes, but we don't entirely understand the pathophysiology of why.
And it's not common enough that it's actually been able to be studied.
That's right. So it's each individual is a case report, and it's kind of noted that this has been observed.
What about rheumatoid arthritis? And I'm thinking in particular, does the condition itself, which has some autoimmune components, have an impact on hair? And then what about drugs like methotrexate?
So yes and yes is the short answer to both questions. It is still not common. So I would say that it's less than 5% of rheumatoid arthritis patients will have a hair loss as a true associated symptom of their autoimmune disease. Keep in mind that rheumatologic conditions are autoinflammatory syndromes. So these are syndromes that increase the inflammatory mediators in our body in autoinflammatory cells, such as autoantibodies. And so any type of kind of inflammatory state in the body can lead to hair loss. And it's a stress-type hair loss, so it's a telogen effluvium-type hair loss. But it's not as common as we would think with rheumatoid arthritis. Again, it's about less than 5% of patients. Then there are the medications that we use to treat rheumatoid arthritis that slow cell division, right? Because we want to slow the cells, those immune cells that are attacking the wrong thing, which is ourselves, right? And so it can also affect those rapidly dividing cells in our hair follicle that are making hair. And so methotrexate is one of them. Although the incidence is pretty low of hair loss with methotrexate, it is still there. Leflunomide, sulfasalazine, all of the medications that are used, these DMARDs is what they're called, they've all been reported to cause hair loss in not an insignificant percentage of patients.
Are there any other diseases that also cause just the disease itself causing hair loss?
Many of those autoinflammatory syndromes, such as lupus or thyroid disease, these autoinflammatory syndromes can also have hair loss as an associated symptom.
I'd like to change gears for a moment and talk about what we do to our hair. And sometimes it's pretty scary. So people will put all kinds of colors in their hair. Sometimes they're temporary, sometimes they're more permanent. And I'm curious what the latest is when it comes to the question of carcinogenicity, because if you dial back 30 years, there was a big controversy about hair dye and cancer, and perhaps even people who worked in hair salons and their vulnerability. So I'm sure you have kept up with this. It's probably still controversial. I kind of remember that blondes have less worry than brunettes when it comes to hair coloring, but I haven't kept up with the literature. So what's the inside scoop?
I'm super impressed that you knew that little tidbit about blondes having less exposure. And it's true. They have overall less exposure because we're actually removing pigment from the follicle. Most common is peroxide, right? Peroxide we know a lot about. It's been around a long, long time. And peroxide can facilitate removing pigment from a hair follicle and leaving you with blonde hair. Whereas darkening the hair means that you're putting a stain on the actual hair shaft, and that needs to stay there. And they're semi-permanent. So semi-permanent means it leaves your hair follicle, washes off like a sunless tanner. It washes off our skin in some time. Semi-permanent hair dye will wash off the hair, or more permanent hair dye that will really last the life of that hair. I mean the life of the hair until that hair cycles out of anagen and into telogen and falls out. That hair will remain the color that it's been dyed, and people just have to have their roots done. Right. And the longer lasting hair dyes, we worried about more because you can imagine the exposure to the person is longer. But the data hasn't really panned out that there's any one hair dye that causes cancer.
Are there any hair products we actually should avoid, whether because they're just not good for our hair or they're not good for our health?
You know, it really kind of depends on the type of processing that you do for your hair. We used to think that moisturizing your hair with oils prior to heat processing would actually protect the hair, but we found that that actually wasn't true with
Permanente. It fries it
just like a French fry. That's right. So you coat it in oil, you apply heat, and it fries like a French fry, and it actually will break at the surface of the scalp. And in the worst circumstances, that oil will track down to the follicle and potentially singe the follicle and lead to a scarring hair loss.
Ooh.
So that's the heat processing is more of an issue. More than any kind of gels, mousses, or even dyes, it's the processing that can be problematic. Heat processing causes the cuticle of the hair shaft to fray, and when it frays, it's more likely to break. I think one thing that can be helpful to patients that have suffered a massive breakage from maybe too much processing or peroxide being left on the hair too long that will weaken the shaft and cause it to break is that it didn't make the hair fall out of their head. And so that's deep in the skin. The hair follicle is deep in the skin and really more or less protected from many of these processing with the exception of the French fry. And so they're getting a breakage, but they didn't lose the hair out of their head. It's going to grow back.
It will grow back.
That's right.
But in the meantime, it's pretty traumatic.
In the meantime, it's traumatic and it's a long, hard wait.
A lot of people think that what they put on their scalp or on their skin stays on their scalp, stays on their skin. It doesn't get into the body. I don't have to worry about what we call systemic absorption. But there have been studies fairly recently. For example, the Food and Drug Administration actually paid for a pretty complicated study that demonstrated ingredients in sunscreen get absorbed into the body. And I think a lot of people were somewhat surprised to discover that. I'm wondering about some of the ingredients in our hair products, especially our moisturizers, the shampoos, and all of the mousses, the gels. We hear so much about phthalates and other endocrine disruptors that are used in a lot of these cosmetics. And they don't have to list the ingredients on the label like if it were a medicine. Should we be concerned about phthalates and endocrine disruptors in some of our hair products?
Phthalates are added to many, many personal products, and I'm sure that they're also added to hair products, but they need to be listed in the ingredient list just like everything else. And there are whole lines of hair products and beauty products and personal care products that will state that they are phthalate-free. And so if this is something that you are concerned about, I tell patients to research that, to find products that are phthalate-free. We don't know the dose or the exposure or the significance of phthalates as far as how much is dangerous. Just like many of the products that we apply to our skin or many of the foods that we eat, everything is more or less, many things are going into our body. And it doesn't mean that they're necessarily dangerous. We just have a lot to learn.
Dr. Adigan, what should we do to keep our hair healthy? What is your top recommendation?
And not just what we put on our hair, but what we put in our bodies. And are there any dietary supplements that might be beneficial?
That's a great question. I mean, I think that much like anything in overall health and well-being, a balanced diet will go a long way for your skin, hair, nails, all of our skin and appendages, as I like to say. And some of the key factors that we need to think about are, say, essential fatty acids, right? And that we get those from different types of fish as well as vegetables. We also see more pronounced hair loss in patients that are zinc deficient. And so zinc supplementation can be very safe as well as effective for improving the overall health of our hair. One thing that we do see in patients that are biotin deficient, we will also notice a hair loss. What we don't necessarily know is, will biotin supplementation then lead to improved hair quality or hair growth? What I do like to ask patients is if they're on any kind of crash diet, such as a ketogenic diet, that can be a biotin wasting type diet. Those are patients that I would consider doing biotin supplementation for their hair. There are a number of new supplements available that have shown interesting and promising data to improving hair quality and hair growth. So that means improved texture, diameter, as well as density. And so some of these products, there's different brands. One is known as Viviscal. Another one is known as Nutrafol. And each of these agents have a proprietary blend of supplements that are, they are produced to improve the health of the hair follicle environment. So if we go back to kind of earlier in the program, we're talking about there's so many factors that lead to healthy hair growth, and we can't just tell the hair to grow or tell the hair to not grow, to fall out rather. We have to create the environment that will promote its growth. And so these products have different types of marine complexes that have shown improved hair growth, whereas Nutrafol has certain agents that will decrease inflammation around the hair follicle. One of the agents is known as ashwagandha. I know that I'm not pronouncing it perfectly, but it comes from Ayurvedic medicine, and that leads to a anti-inflammatory environment around the hair follicle. In fact, in one of their studies, they found the patients on the treatment arm were overall less stressed than the patients in the placebo arm. So these are really exciting agents that have been showing promise for years. So sustained promise for patients with either inflammatory type hair loss or even just telogen effluvium from medications or stress or even from pattern hair loss.
Dr. Chris Adigan, thank you so much for talking with us on The People's Pharmacy today.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Dr. Chris Adigan. She's a board-certified dermatologist who practices at the Dermatology and Laser Center of Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
And Joe, I think it's important to remember that a diet that is very restricted is very possibly going to have some impact on hair.
Well, we hear it over and over again. A well-balanced diet, meaning a diet that's rich in vegetables and fruits, 7 servings of vegetables each day, and the right kind of fats, more the omega-3 fats than the potentially inflammatory omega-6 fats could be beneficial.
And perhaps some monounsaturated fats like olive oil.
Like olive oil, precisely. And what are some of the other good healthy fats?
Well, good healthy fats. Well, you have avocados,
that's what
of
I was
course,
thinking.
And
mm-hmm.
nuts.
Yeah.
And
now,
seeds.
One quick caution about biotin. For people who are taking biotin for their hair, and Dr. Adigan mentioned that as a possibility, it can throw off a thyroid test.
That is correct. So you want to be very careful about that.
And if you'd like to learn more about ashwagandha, we do have some information on our website. Dr. Tarone Lodog mentioned that it's helpful for people who are wired but tired.
Lynn Siegel produced today's show. Al Wodarski engineered. Dave Graydon edits our interviews.
The People's Pharmacy is produced at the studios of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.
The People's Pharmacy theme music is by B.J. Lederman.
The People's Pharmacy is brought to you in part by Verizana, an analytical laboratory providing home health tests for hormones, gut health, and the microbiome, online at verizana.com.
And by CocoVia, the maker of high-potency cocoflavanol supplements that support cognitive and cardiovascular health. More information at cocovia.com.
You can also get a CD of today's show or download the free podcast at peoplespharmacy.com.
When you visit our site, you can share your thoughts about today's show. Have you experienced hair loss? Do you know what triggered it? Please tell us about it and what you did, if anything, to counteract it.
At peoplespharmacy.com, you can sign up for our free online newsletter or subscribe to the free podcast of the show.
When you sign up for the newsletter, you'll get our free e-guide to favorite home remedies.
In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. Thanks for listening. Please join us again next week.